And I thank Waxman for the kind, the two kind words. And I even more thank him for the opportunity, not as a speaker, although it's a quite a kavod to be in this incredible Makom Torah and to have the opportunity to share with you some thoughts. It's a responsibility I try not to take lightly, but really as just a regular person who is working on the avoda of this month. I try not to repeat myself wherever possible, especially in audiences that may have heard things that I've had to say before. But in responding to the invitation and to the introduction, I do have to repeat what I think I say every year, because what I feel every year. It's what I feel when I get the call about coming, how excited I am to just be here during this time of year. It's really for three reasons, I was thinking. First of all, because of that beautiful introduction. Not because I believe any of it, but because we know there are two schools of thought in the way of Musar that we've had in our Masorah. One is the way of convincing of ourselves of how low we are, and the other one is to build up a little bit. I think it's good for all of us to hear. Those were nice words about what I someday hope to be, and that is definitely an inspiration in my own personal avod of tshuva. We don't have that in mind. We don't hear things that can tell us a little bit about what we're capable of being. I hope to someday be the person that Rav Waxman just described. Secondly, maybe more importantly, there's a major element, one that perhaps we take for granted, especially in yeshiva, and we do not think about enough, but the kulam aguda achas element of our tfilos and our avoda. There's an element of dibuk chaveirim that is never meant to be defined geographically, the type of dveikus that we have with the chever that's around us in any particular time. When you have the opportunity to come together with so many very, very wonderful and special friends and talmidim who are friends and friends who are talmidim, and all of whom are rabbeim to you, and all of whom you learn from in the way that they act and the way they do things, that's an opportunity one would be very, very foolish to pass up, especially in these special days and hours so close to the onset of Rosh Hashanah, the Aseres Yemei Teshuvah, and Yom Kippur. So much as we may have an opportunity to greet each other warmly, I'd like to have long conversations with so many of you and catch up on the past month or the past couple of years and have some of the follow-up on that. Just being here in the same room with so many people whom I feel a very, very close and special kesher with makes it more than worthwhile, and I appreciate the opportunity. But most importantly, as I try to say every year, I have the zechus of teaching in a yeshiva all the time, and there is no time of the year that I appreciate that as much as in the month of Elul and during the days of Aseres Yemei Teshuva. And to invest oneself more and more into being in yeshiva during these days is the most important thing a person can do. There are many places to daven. I'll just give you one word of advice about your future Yamim Noram experiences as they may come. There are many wonderful places to daven. There are many important obligations of Kibud Aveim, and I'm not for a minute suggesting that you don't daven when you go back with your family and with your father and with your siblings and the rest of the family. But when you have the opportunity to choose between different places, the quality of the melodies, of the voice, of the tunes, matters far less than the nature of the assembled people there. And there is no better place to be than in a yeshiva of any kind. Because we know that when it comes to growth, when it comes to change in the world, there are two pervasive attitudes, two different approaches that we can take, and all of us are guilty far too often of making the wrong choice. There is an attitude of, in our life and the things around us, that's just the way it is. Some things will never change. It was even a very popular song that I think was remade into a popular rap song as well. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. The song was describing, if I'm not mistaken, race relations in the United States of America. That's why it was very good fodder. I mean this seriously. To become a remade rap song speaking about a lot of the same themes and ideas about the way that blacks and whites get along with each other in America. There is an attitude. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That is death to tshuva. That is the opposite of these days. That's the attitude of being set in our ways and just shrugging our shoulders and accepting realities for the way they are. There is another approach of tshuva. There is something more dynamic, something more organic, something that screams to us that everything can change. And there's no such thing as that's just the way it is. And that's just the way it is an excuse. Any politician, it could be Barack Obama, it could be anybody else in the world, their advertising slogan is going to be, yes, we can. Their advertising slogan is going to be change. or change that we can believe in. There's never been a politician in America or in Israel who put a bumper sticker out or a sign on the front lawn that said, vote for me, that's just the way it is. Vote for me if you want things to be staying exactly the same. Not the way we speak when we want to inspire and we want to excite. Even in our own communities, we are often, far too often, surrounded by, and even ourselves contribute to, that's just the way it is. Any great yeshiva rejects that's just the way it is. There's no such thing as that's just the way it is when you're learning a Tosfos. There's no such thing that's just the way it is when you're trying to break down a sugya. There's no such thing as that's just the way it is when we're doing Shnai Mikra. And there certainly is no such thing as that's just the way it is when we're working on Tikkun Amidos, when we're working on Avodas Hashem, when we're working on become better people, better Jews, when we're working on ourselves. And that attitude, that rejection of that's just the way it is, permeates any type of experience in the days leading up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It certainly defines the uplifting tefillos. The chazan, of course, contributes, and the songs help, and the ruach, all of that, and the beautiful words themselves composed, whether it's by a paitan, whether it's by the Anshei Knesset, wherever the words we're saying, whether they're psukim themselves and the musaf that maybe we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, all of that contributes. But where the ultimate lift comes from is that sense of rejection of that's just the way it is, and that desire to grow. You will have the opportunity, you already have the opportunity. And I'm just privileged to be part of it for a couple of minutes, just to share in that unmistakable vibe, that unmistakable energy of that's not just the way it is. Tomorrow will be something different, that next year will be something different, that the person that I am, that my attitude towards learning, my attitude towards davening, my attitude towards Bein Adam Chaveiro is subject to change in the next few minutes, in the next few days and weeks, and for the rest of my life. That's something unique to every yeshiva as opposed to the rest of the world, and I certainly believe it's unique to this yeshiva, even within the Olam HaYeshivos, and it's very, very special for me. I take so long. This is not just a response, and not because we have nothing else to talk about. These are my strong feelings of Hakaras HaTov for being able to take part, at least in a few minutes, and to be here. I can't tell you the type of hashpa and influence it will have on my own avoda over these days heading to Rosh Hashanah. There is an incredibly simple question that has a very, very complex series of answers, and I'm going to give you a disclaimer from the beginning that I do not, it's not a chiddush that we're not going to be able to fully resolve this issue. We're not even going to be able to talk about it that much. And the main suggestion I want to make to you isn't a particularly good one. It's not the real answer to the question, as I will point out to you, but it might help us a little bit as we grapple with the question, and it might give us, even if it has no impact on the question and doesn't help at all to answer, at least it'll give us something to think about. I'll explain everything what I mean. We do know that we're about to enter into Yemei HaDin, Yom HaDin. We are going to stand in judgment. And we talk about this explicitly throughout the davening and throughout our learning about Rosh Hashanah, Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and Yom Kippur. The notion of standing in judgment on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Berosh Hashanah Yikasevun, Uviyom Tzom Kippurim Yichasemun. The notion of the fact that it will be written and then it will be hanging in balance for many of us who might be in the category of Beinonim through the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, maybe more of us than we might think, and ending up sealed, our fate decided on Yom Kippur. What does that simple, every child knows that identity of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. What does all of that suggest to us regarding the rest of the year and tshuva that is going to be possible when we recite a Motzai Yom HaKippurim V'hurachum Yechaper Avon, and we begin anew, not just the process of living our lives, but we begin anew the process of tshuva? What does it mean for a person who is not privileged to have the type of awakening and inspiration that we might have this Yom Kippur, this Rosh Hashanah, and might not have it until Chanukah or Purim or Pesach or Shavuos, or maybe over next summer? That's when the person will be inspired. Do we really believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks down on that person and says, too late, what can I tell you? Yom Kippur, it was sealed, signed, sealed, and delivered. This is obviously, like I said, it's an incredibly simple question. We have to ask it if we're going to have any serious relationship with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But what does any of that mean? If we believe for a minute that something is decided on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that means that it's not decided and there's not much that can change it. Okay, so some people say it doesn't mean that at all. It sets in motion a certain chazakah, a certain pattern. Of course, there always could be tshuva. Some people flat out reject that idea. Rav Charlap, not the Rav Charlap who was in YU for many years from the Bronx, but his father, one of the great Talmidim of Rav Kook, one of the great Tzaddikim of Yerushalayim. He has a number of Svarim on a whole lot of things, Mei Marom, and especially on these days, Ori V'Yishi, on the Yomim Noram. So Rav Charlap and many, many others make the suggestion slightly more radical, that Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, they are days of judgment just like every other day. Yom HaTzmaut is a day of judgment, then May 1st is a day of judgment, then Cinco de Mayo, they're all days of judgment. I'm not comparing Yom Kippur to Cinco de Mayo, but these are all days of judgment on the calendar. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always looking at us, and we're always davening, and we're always being judged for the things that we do. But there is a unique judgment at different times of the year for different things, and the judgment on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is on how well we take advantage of our opportunities. Yeshua Hashem Behimatzo, this coming Sunday afternoon, we'll read the words from Yeshaya in the Haftorah of Atana Sibor. Yeshua Hashem Behimatzo, seek out God where He is close. Most of us generally assume that that is advice. Rav Charlap suggests it's imperative. What does it say about us in our relationship to Hashem if when Hashem is close, we do not go to see Him? Imagine a person has a very, very close friend, and they not in the best of contact. It's hard by email and the time difference and the phone bills. It's a difficult thing to do to stay in touch when they're in yeshiva. So you cling to the notion, and the whole world clings to the notion, that you're best friends with this person and your circumstances have driven you apart. Then the person comes for a 10-day trip in December. They're here in January. They're sitting in the yeshiva shalvim, and I don't once find the time to go over and speak to that person and have a conversation. So I no longer can claim we're best friends. Zezra of Charlap, Yeshua Hashem and Behimotso, that is an imperative, it's a commandment. There is a special uplifting energy that we described before that permeates Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And if I sit back, shrug my shoulders, slump back in my chair, and don't take advantage of that, so Hagufa is the judgment. It's not that I'm being judged on my life more, I'm being judged on my Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur more. That's how he explains, it's not for now the full explanation, but that's how he explains Kivnei Marom, the way we march in front of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and even the different opinions in the Gemara. It's a very, very nice and wonderful approach. It's a little bit novel. It's a jarring to us to believe that there's anything but din and judgment going on in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur for our entire year. But at least, like I said, it solves the problem. I want to make to you, like I said, a suggestion which is nowhere near as profound as Rav Charlap's. It's not my own. It's still not as profound as Rav Charlap's because it doesn't really answer the question. I'm going to tell you in advance, it specifically doesn't answer what it means, the chasima on Yom Kippur, but it is a particular kavana that perhaps we can share heading in, at the very least, through Rosh Hashanah. And maybe throughout Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and maybe, as we'll see in a couple of minutes, even through Yom Kippur itself. And it takes a step backwards instead of getting deeper. Again, I try to be a simple person, and you can get all of the other profundities from your other Rabbeim and other Sichot. We'll share an incredibly basic point today that hopefully will help you in the same ways that it continues to help me. Right around the time that YU Torah became as incredibly popular and effective as it was, so in addition to publishing or posting shiurim from around the globe, if anybody who has any even distant connection to YU gets a banner and shiurim galore up there, so they decided to go back and archive also. And there were quite a few really treasure chests of shiurim from yesteryear that made their way to the light of the day. One of the first ones that they did, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb was a very, very diligent and copious note taker in the time before he was president of YU, when he was still involved in Rabbanus in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And he wrote down almost all of his shiurim. They didn't have audio copies of shiurim from the 60s, but they had a great number of his notes of actual transcripts of these shiurim that he gave. He wrote them in advance, obviously. Most of them were drushos and Shabbos. Twice. In 1964, and significantly, as you'll hear in a minute, in 1969, not because of the Mets or the Jets, there were other things that went on in 1969, significantly in 1969, Rabbi Lamb gave the same drasha. He repeated himself in two different places with a couple of changes, 1964 and 1969. Rabbi Lamb analyzed a Gemara in Maseches Eruvin. The Gemara Maseches Eruvin makes the following statement. It's on Daf Nun Dalet Amud Aleph. And the Gemara Maseches Eruvin makes the following statement, which you'll hear right away, sounds a bit strange. The Gemara makes the statement in the name of Shmuel. Chatof v'echol, chatof v'ishtei. The Alma d'azlinan minei kihilula da'ami. Now we know that eat, drink, and be merry is not the slogan of any Ben Torah. And yet Shmuel says something that is perilously close to eat, drink, and be merry. Chatof ve'chol, chatof ve'shtei. Grab and eat, grab and drink. The Alma d'azlinan minei kihilula da'ami. Or da'ami. Let me compare. Because the world from which we are going is like a wedding. It is compared to a wedding. The whole world is a party. The whole world is a wedding. So eat and drink at there and enjoy yourself. Rashi and many other Rishonim say that this is obviously a reference either to Tanugei Ruchni, obviously a reference to the wonderful pleasures that a Ben Torah can enjoy in the spiritual realm, or perhaps it is a reference to the permissible Ta'anugei Olam Hazeh, the way in which a person can enjoy himself in this world from all types of physical pleasures, food and drink and the like. And the message of Shmuel is, the message, of course, super appropriate for these days, the messages of limited time. Eat and drink, because the world is a wedding and a party and a feast, and it does not last forever. Those words are implied in the word da'azlinan minei, the world that will not always be at our fingertips. The world da'azlinan minei that eventually we will live. There's only so much we can do, only so much we can accomplish. Get busy already with it. Whether it's the famous story of the Vilna Gaon and kissing the tzitzis and his value and appreciation for those mitzvahs, even klape olam haba, even klape the olam ha'emes, what an incredible world and what incredible skara with us. Or as Rashi says explicitly, the physical pleasures, even HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us so many gifts, we should enjoy them because it does not last forever. This is the time to enjoy them. The wedding, the band will eventually stop playing. Enjoy it while you can. Rabbi Lamb observes, of course, that even with that explanation, and even with that very, very appropriate directive of understand that time, the good times don't last forever, enjoy things while we can, it still seems to be a very odd thing for Shmuel to say. It still seems, as we said, to be way too close to eat, drink, and be merry. First of all, if you mean ta'anugei ruchni, if you mean all of the wonderful spiritual pleasures, so say so. Don't compare them to the type of gluttonous eating and drinking that goes on at a smorgasbord in Marina Del Rey. Don't compare that to a wedding. Don't compare that to behaviors that we wouldn't necessarily associate with the most exalted spirit. It's a weird metaphor to use, if it's a metaphor at all. And the very statement of take advantage of this world while you have it to mean anything but spiritual pleasures, it certainly seems odd. Rabbi Lamb quotes from the Gedolei Chassidus, who make a brilliant alternative explanation. And they explain that it has nothing to do with the hours, the sands of a clock going down. It has nothing to do with time passing. It has to do with a different phenomenon associated with a wedding. And there's no way that either the Gedolei Chassidus, or I imagine even Rabbi Lamb in the 60s, knew this phenomenon as well. Says Rabbi Lamb, the world is filled with all sorts of different things. There are all sorts of different pursuits, all sorts of different accomplishments. All of them make sense. All of them are justified when they are in the context of a wedding, when they are in the context of a celebration of the union between Chassan and Kala. In this instance, the Chassan and Kala, outside of the metaphor, in the Nimshal, the Chassid and Kala being referred to by the Gemara in the Nimshal are Knesset Yisrael, or us, the Jewish people, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When the world is the union between man and God, eat, drink, because the world is a wedding. Because every Davar Gashmi is there to be utilized in the purpose of Avodas Hashem. But when the world is not a wedding, listen carefully to the next sentence, when the world is not a wedding, when the entire essence of my being is not this union between man and the Ribono Shel Olam, between finite man and the infinite God, when that is lacking from the picture, then even Divrei Ruchni, even my spiritual pursuits, lose their significance and lose their meaning. And I'll tell you what I mean when I said that I don't know what the Gedolei Chassidus and I don't know what Rabbi Lamb had in mind. Have you ever, and if I'm insulting you or your dad, I apologize, Vance, You know, there's that awkward moment at modern weddings when the band, who are being paid anyway, they get going a little bit, and you know, the salad course, if you're even into that salad course, the salad course is done, but the pictures are taking forever. So there's always like that 10 to 15%, depending on the wedding, who like hit the dance floor and they start going crazy. And like, why? Why are you dancing, right? Okay, it's a song and you like to dance, but what is the point? Why are we singing Chazakah? They're taking pictures like three floors away from here. They're nowhere near the wedding. They'll dance the Hora sometimes. They'll be a little bit, you know, not the real music, but the people just want to get a head start. It makes sense to dance at a wedding when there's a chasen and kala. When we're fulfilling the mitzvah to be mesameach chasen and kala, that's what we're there for. And again, if you like to dance, there's obviously no crime in it, but there's always that awkward moment. Like you wonder, should I, shouldn't I? And you ask yourself, why would I? Unless I'm overcome with the desire right now to dance around the room, it's no different than any other Wednesday night because the chasen and kala aren't here. When the chasen or kala are here, so the dancing makes sense, and the drinking makes sense, and the eating makes sense. All of it fits into the proper context that allows it to make sense. All of it fits the puzzle in a much more meaningful, beautiful type of way. I mentioned to you the significance of 1969. Listen to the poetry of Rabbi Lamb as he describes what was going on then, and amazingly, it is equally going on now. Rabbi Lamb writes, these are his words, not mine, it is no exaggeration to say that especially we of the 20th century, 1964 and 1969, stand in great need of this teaching that the whole world is a wedding. That life is only worth living if it makes sense, and it makes sense only if there is a purpose, and the purpose is loyalty to God. The wedding of our talents and substance and destiny with the will of God as taught in Torah. For we moderns have developed as never before the perfection of means, science, the exploitation of nature. It's a highly refined skill. Business, commerce, trade are complicated arts. Communication and transportation are affected with consummate speed. We know how to do things like never before. The trouble is we do not always know why we are doing them. We have an elaborate technology in which we are so intoxicated with means that are efficient that we have forgotten the ends. Never before have we been able to go so fast. Never before have we been so unsure of where it is we want to go. Why did he add that paragraph in 1969? Because 1969, man landed on the moon. And Rabbi Lamb writes, we can land a man on the moon, but after having done so triumphantly, we begin to wonder what we are doing there in the first place. I am not sure, and please don't be insulted by this, I am not sure if I have ever seen as good a metaphor. Now we're going to get a little bit personal, and we're going to get a little bit intense, so please bear with me. I am not sure if I have ever in my life read as good a metaphor, as strong an indictment of our post-high school yeshiva learning system than that paragraph. Our means are great. We're able to do things like never before. We're flying through learning. We're davening long Shemona Esrei. We're doing all sorts of things that are elevated. We are spiritually landing a man on the moon. The miracles of technology of 1969, I have no doubt, are being repeated in this base medrash every single day. No less an accomplishment of godless Adam than putting a man on the moon is taking an uninspired, not that anybody here was uninspired ever, but taking an uninspired high school, modern Orthodox youth and lighting them on fire here in this base medrash, here in this yeshiva. It is like landing a man on the moon. And for that we can say we can land a man on the moon, but after having done so triumphantly, we begin to wonder what we are doing there in the first place. It's a metaphor, an indictment for the type of dancing and the type of eating that goes on. And it goes on with full hislavas and with full energy and with something that is empty in the middle. With a hole in the middle where we are not exactly sure why are we doing any of those things exactly in the first place. What is making us do those doing those things? And he describes further, without it, things become dull and they become senseless along the way. Rav Rosenzweig has a suggestion regarding Yom Kippur, but it's certainly applicable to Rosh Hashanah on a certain level as well. It's decidedly not Rosh Hashanah in its fullness, but it certainly has application to Rosh Hashanah, as you'll hear in a minute. Rav Rosenzweig suggests that first the psukim themselves, then the Gemaras, which we probably won't have time for, and finally the Rambam, in multiple instances, in multiple formulations, go out of their way, the Torah itself, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, and then the Rambam, the Gemara, all following that lead from an interpretation and insight into the Pesukim, to describe Yom Kippur as more a Shabbos than a Yom Tov. Of course, the most obvious application of that is the Shabbos, Shabbaton designation, Shabbat, Shabbaton designation that is given to Yom Kippur in its description in the Pesukim and Parshas Emor. It's not the only time we have that designation. Right after in the same Pasuk where it says Shabbat, Shabbaton, Shabbat, Shabbaton, it says Tish Besu, Shabbatchem. It refers to it again in this double language, the super Shabbos. You should Shabbos, Shabbos. That becomes the nature of Yom Kippur. Gets deeper than that as well. We know that every Yom Tov, as Rosa Zweig points out, every single Yom Tov on the calendar is made up of two distinct parts. It has its general, universal Yom Tov mentality. What he refers to, what the Torah refers to as Mikra Kodesh, Mikra Kodesh, it is a holy day declared and designated as holy. And then it has its unique and special designation. Chag HaMatzos, Chag HaBikurim, whatever it's going to be, Yom Teruah, however the Torah describes the special uniqueness of the day. So what are we going to celebrate come Wednesday evening, Thursday morning? It's really two things at once. It is a day, a Mikra Kodesh, and it is a Yom Tov. Certain characteristics that emanate from that. And it has the special designation and the special characteristics of a Yom Teruah of all the uniqueness that Rosh Hashanah entails. Because of that dual nature, so we know that there is a phrase that reappears again and again in the Parshas of the Moadim, in Parshas Emor, where the Torah says again and again, Mikra Kodesh Yelachem, Kol Melacha Lo Sasu, Kol Melachas Avodah Lo Sasu. The fact that we refrain from doing Melacha is because it is a Yom Tov more than anything else. There's only one exception. That exception, of course, is Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, we are told, Mikra Kodesh Yelachem, it is a Yom Tov, V'inisem es nafsho seichem, the only Yom Tov, only day on our calendar, whose unique characteristic is associated with Mikra Kodesh. Moreover, why is it that we don't do Melacha on Yom Kippur? V'chol Melacha lo sasu, not because it's a Yom Tov, V'etzem ha-Yom hazeh, ki Yom Kippurim hu, l'chaper aleichem. The reason why we don't do Melacha, points out Rav Rosenzweig explicit in the Pasuk, the reason why we don't do Melacha is because of the fact that it is Yom Kippur. The reason why we don't do Melacha on Sukkot is because of Mikra Kodesh. The reason why we don't do Melacha on Shavuos, Mikra Kodesh. The reason why we don't do Melacha on Yom Kippur is because it is Yom Kippur. Rav Rosenzweig explains, and we'll see this more explicitly in the Rambam in a minute, Rav Rosenzweig explains again what's going on there, what does that mean? Because the Shabbos special day dimension, and especially as we'll see the Isser Melacha dimension, is not simply the Mikra Kodesh, it is the essence of what Yom Kippur is. More than anything else, Yom Kippur is a super Shabbos. The Rambam doesn't have a Hilchos Yom HaKippurim. Rav Rosenzweig points out, the Rambam takes this Lashon seriously of Shabbat, Shabbaton, and the Rambam refers to Hilchos Shvisas Esor. Shvisas Esor, he borrows not the Torah's language, but he borrows the language of Shabbos in describing Yom Kippur. What is the order of the halachos in Seder's Manim that the Ram has in the Mishnah Torah? The Rambam starts with the laws of Shabbos, he moves to Erevin, and what should come next? Well, it depends how you play it around, but there is a Hilchos Yom Tov. But Hilchos Yom Tov doesn't come next. The Rambam goes from Shabbos to Erevin to Shvisas Asur to Yom Tov, and then the rest of the specific Yomim Tovim. It falls out on the Shabbos side of things, not the Yom Tov side of things. Lest you think that is simply because of the significance and the Chi of Kares because of it, you look how the Rambam begins. When the Rambam begins the laws of Shabbos, he talks about Isser Melacha. When the Rambam begins the laws of Yom Tov, he talks about Isser Melacha. When the Rambam begins the laws of Yom Kippur, he talks about Isser Melacha. He talks about Isser Melacha. Not at the beginning of Hilchos Chametz Umatzah, not at the beginning of Hilchos Shofar, but the first halacha that the Rambam says and that he talks about in Yom Kippur is the fact that we're not allowed to do Melacha. The Rambam, when he describes the Inuyim, what verb does the Rambam use? Does anybody know? What verb does the Rambam use in Perek Aleph, Halacha Dalet, of Hilchos Shvisas Esor? What does the Rambam say? The Rambam describes the fact that we have to be Lishbos Bo, Me'achila Vishtiyah. Again, a shivisa from eating and drinking. In fact, the Rodas Wai points to an alternative girsa in Halacha Hay in the same Perek. There the Rambam describes, it's a weird statement no matter what, but the Rambam says, U'mitzvah lishpos mikol elu. The mitzvah again to have shivisa from these chameshi nuyim, from the eating, the drinking, the leather shoes, and the rest. Kiderach sheshoves me'achila v'shtia. What's the Rambam adding? Don't wear leather shoes the same way you don't eat or drink. Same punishment, same idea. Well, there's an alternative girsa that says, don't wear leather shoes the same way not you eat and drink, but the same way you don't do malacha. These are extreme iser malachas. Yom Kippur is extreme Shabbos. Explains Rav Rosenzweig very, very simply. What does that mean? Rav Rosenzweig says that the essential difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov is that Yom Tov is defined as Chatzi Lachem, Chatzi Lashem. Shabbos is defined as Yom Shekulo Shabbos. Shabbos is defined as Kulo Lashem. The first description in the Parsha of the Mon of Shabbos, Al Teitzei Ish Mim Komo by Yom HaShvi'i. Shabbos, we stay focused and we do not engage in the world. The laws of having people over, of even being Mekabel Pnei Rabo, there are no Tiulim that we take on Shabbos. Because of the halachas of Tchum and because of Erev, it becomes exceedingly difficult to do. All of the things that we embrace and we need to embrace on Yom Tov, around us in the world, they go away on Shabbos. Shabbos is meant to be Kulo Lashem. And Yom Kippur is meant to be exceptionally Kulo Lashem. Ad kidei kach, that the very serious obligation that we have to be Mekadesh, everything in the world, by making Kiddush and by eating a piece of Kugel and by having all this Dibur Chaverim, there's none of that on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is Kulo Kulo Lashem, and that's the reason why we don't eat, and that's the reason we don't drink, and that's the reason why we'll dress after married in a kittel, and that's the reason why we'll be like Malachim, because human beings are not even capable of that idea. Yom Kippur makes sure that the Hilula described by Rabbi Lamb actually takes place. Before we get to the Madrega of Kulo Hashem, and I will suggest to you that Rosh Hashanah, even though it does have the permissibility and even the encouragement, according to many, to eat and to have that type of Yom Tov experience, Rosh Hashanah is already training wheels for what Yom Kippur is going to be. Before we can dream about Kulo Hashem, we need to have at least partially Hashem. We need to hit the level where Hashem is part of what we're doing on some level or another. Make no mistake about it. A person can be engaged in divrei ruchni. A person can be engaged in all sorts of types of avodas Hashem and leave Hashem out of the equation. He's at a wedding, he's wearing a tuxedo. He ate at the shmorg and he's dancing on the floor. But if you ask him, where's the chasid and kala, he shrugs his shoulder and has no idea. He's on a spaceship that has made it to the moon and he's walking around up there, the most incredible type of aliyah, the most incredible type of growth. But if you ask him why he's there, what he's doing, and why he came, he's not really 100% sure. The marriage, the center, is missing. We're not exactly sure where it came. The Yom Shekulo LaHashem, it's not being about me, that's not there for us anymore. You know, I mentioned, reluctantly, a rap version of a song before, so I might as well go even a little bit further. Right at the beginning, when rap came out, when rap first became popular, so there was this tremendous, as you might imagine, from mainstream culture and music critics and rabbis and religious leaders, there was this enormous, enormous backlash against rap. It's still till today. There are certain types of kosher types of music, and I'm not suggesting to you that rap should be on that list, because for many obvious reasons, much of rap is completely at odds and antithetical to any Ben Torah's existence. I'm not suggesting otherwise for even a fraction of a second. But there was this incredible backlash against this new type of music, from a music perspective even. Forget about the lyrics and the words and the messages. Even as an art form, even as a music genre, there was a tremendous amount of snobbery, as you'll hear in a minute, mostly from the Caucasian white world, against this new type of music. And there's a comedian you may know, Chris Rock. So Chris Rock once said about it, it wasn't even meant to have, it's not funny. I don't think he meant it as a joke. But I take it into my Rosh Hashanah, Lahat, I take it in, his insight. Chris Rock said, he said, it makes me crazy. I'll go to the supermarket and there'll be two old white ladies and they'll be talking about, oh, I don't like that music. I don't care for that music. And he says he wants to drop his groceries, look them in the eye and say to them, ladies, it's not for you. We know you don't like it. You're not supposed to like it. You're not the audience of the music in the first. I'm supposed to be upset that you don't like my music? The music is not for you. And I can assure you, the audience for whom this music is intended, they like it just fine. That's what he said. Then why do I say that? Take that into Rosh Hashanah? Because I have something against little old ladies in the supermarket? I love little old ladies in the supermarket. I would root for them in most every debate between them and Chris Rock in the world of rap. So why would I take his statement with me into Rosh Hashanah? Because whenever we do anything, we're playing to an audience. We are familiar with what it means to be judged by an audience. The question is, what is the constitution of that audience? Who makes up that audience? Who, with a capital W, makes up that audience? Who are we trying to please? When we do everything we've done over the past month, when we have all of our plans for the rest of our lives, who is the audience that we are playing to? I didn't believe this until I had it confirmed by multiple people. A friend of mine had an old college professor in psychology. He didn't have a midterm. He didn't have a final in this class. His entire grade depended on a short, it had to be 3 minutes or less presentation. You had to make a visual presentation on the fact, on some idea in basic psychology. The whole grade was based on that. It wasn't the greatest way to grade, but he did it anyway. And there was a masorah in this class. There was a known tradition in this class that the teacher was a pyromaniac. If you do anything with fire, you're going to get an A. If you don't, he's not going to like it no matter how elaborate it is. This guy, this friend of mine, said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. There's no way that it's true. And he came up with a 3-minute presentation that involved hooking a guy up to some kind of pulse machine and rolling some dice and betting a few pennies. And it had to do with a 3-minute hands-on demonstration of actual physiological responses to early gambling addiction that he could simulate the effects of in 3 minutes in front of a classroom. He does this presentation, he worked on it for a very long time. It was very elaborate, it was very complex, and it was very, very moving. Teacher shrugged his shoulders. The next guy walks up, honest to God, I had this confirmed by multiple people. The next guy walks up with a matchbook, and he holds up an unlit match, and he said, this is a normal person. He lights the match, and he said, this is a person who is angry. The teacher gets up out of his chair, starts clapping, and he says, that's what I was looking for, and he gives the guy an A. If I ask you in that story, again, the teacher should be fired, the teacher's a clown, the teacher is terrible, but which of the students is smarter? You have to know your audience all the time. Who are we playing to? Who are we trying to impress? Why do we do the things? I'm going to tell you a little secret. I'm going to use an example that not only isn't relevant to you, but it's not even relevant to too many of your friends. It's been, you know, it's much more out of vogue. Thank God that it's been in the past. Let's talk specifically about smoking cigarettes, but only on one condition. That you don't think that it has nothing to do with us because nobody here smokes cigarettes. That we're able to apply what I'm saying, which I'm purposely not describing fully because I don't want anybody to be defensive and I don't want anybody to reject it. Listen to the following scenario. There's a guy in high school who smokes cigarettes like crazy. He gets to yeshiva after a while, and he hears a few ideas, and he hears a few thoughts about why it's stupid, and he says, you know what, I'm not smoking anymore, so he stops. What happened in that growth period? What changed? So if you don't know any better, you might believe that he was foolish and he became enlightened. You might believe that he had some kind of transformative experience whereby the evils of smoking were shown to him, were displayed to him in a way he understood. Nonsense. That's not what happened at all. When he was in 10th grade on winter vacation in some alleyway in Miami Beach, the audience that he was playing to considered it to be good to smoke, and therefore he smoked. When the audience that he was playing to get the type of respect that he so badly needed, that he so much relied on, he changed back. He still wants to be approved by the audiences that he always had. It's just a question of the audience changing. If a rabbi gives an influential schmooze, half the time it's not the content of the schmooze that matters. It's the rabbi letting know these are the rules of the game by which you will get up. Okay, these are the rules of the game to get approval. So it used to be smoking, then it became basketball, and now it's finishing a masechta. God has nothing to do with it. It's just the rules of the game that are changing around me. I'm not trying to frighten anybody. I'm certainly not trying to discount. I meant what I said in the introduction. I'm not trying to discount any of the learning that we're doing. The learning that we're doing has to be a wedding with a chassid and kala, and it has to be that way all of the time for it to be significant. You know what kind of business it is? Maybe some of your parents are involved in it, in terms of jury recognition in the United States, because if you're going to win a trial, you better know who you're talking to, and you better know who you're trying to impress. You better know who exactly it is that we're speaking to. This is what the Gemara in Erevin is talking about. That's what Yom Shekulo LaHashem means. We don't get distracted even by a lulav and esrog. To elevate the agricultural produce from the field into the service and praise of God, that's beautiful, that's important. That's Chatzil Hashem, that's Chatzil Lachem, and that's the avodah of Sukkot. But Yomim Noram, especially on Yom Kippur, Rosenzweig says, it's Kulo LaHashem. It's a moment of genuine dveikus and connection with the Ribono Shel Olam that defines our religious existence from beginning to end. And that surely is elusive. We often are playing by the rules of the game instead of giving ourselves full opportunity and potential as Avdei Hashem, as putting Hashem in the middle of the circle and understanding that that's why we're doing it. And as crazy as it sounds, and if I didn't know that we could confirm this, all of us, by thinking to ourselves, I wouldn't suggest it because you'd say I was nuts. But as crazy as it sounds, we could be davening to Hashem and still be at a wedding without Hashem there. We certainly could be learning. We certainly could be doing acts of chesed. And there's no Ribono Shel Olam involved in the equation or in the discussion at all. Jonathan Rosenblum, who's a columnist in a number of publications, so he wrote a eulogy a number of years ago, nothing to do with his political or ideological leanings. He wrote a eulogy a number of years ago for a man who davened in a shul, who he referred to and who he knew for many years of this man's life as the man with the gray hat. The man with the gray hat was the person in a sea of Haredi shtibel goers. He was the only one who had the audacity to wear a gray hat amongst all of the other black hats that were there. Jonathan Rosenblum, if you're not aware, is a Baal Tshuva, and he's a person with a different community. He was always in absolutely riveted by this guy, the only guy with the difference of opinion to wear the gray hat. And finally, he got to know him a little bit. He said, "What's with the gray?" He asked him, "What's with the gray hat? What you got? Why do you wear the gray hat?" And the guy said something. Jonathan Rosenblum said it took him years to understand what the guy was even talking about. The guy shrugged his shoulders and said, "Simple. The gray hat. I can wear a gray hat because I know more than them. Listen carefully. It's not us versus them. It's not about what color hat you wear. I couldn't care less. It's not the topic for today." The guy said to Jonathan Rosenblum, "I know more than them." And Jonathan Rosenblum figured out, after many years of thinking about it, you know what he meant? We know there's a saying Chazal tell us, "Ein b'nei chorin el mi she'osek b'torah." The scoffers and the leitzanei hador, they say, you know what that means? Ein b'nei chorin el mi she'osek b'torah. It means if you need somebody to build a sukkah, if you need people to go out to the field, stop by a beis medrash. There are always people who are free. There's no people who are free to go to the beach on a Wednesday afternoon like people who are learning in Kolal. Ein b'nei chorin el mi she'osek b'torah. That's a very, very nasty joke about the Olam HaTorah, that everybody here should do everything in their power to uproot. Not the joke, but the reality. We should be as committed as any lawyer, as any doctor, if not more so, to our storm and our time. Of course, that's not what Chazal meant. So all of us are familiar with all of the Pesach ideas. We're through the whole calendar. All of the Pesach ideas of real Cheirus and real Shiva. Ein b'nei chorin el mi she'osek b'torah means we're all slaves to our taiva. We're all slaves to things around us. And the only freedom comes from Torah. Torah frees the soul. Torah frees the Yetzer Tov. Torah frees our neshama. All of those things, of course, are true. But says Jonathan Rosenblum, quoting this gentleman after he passed away in the eulogy, Ein b'nei chorin el mi she'osek b'torah means that until you are fully invested in Torah, and I will paraphrase here in a minute, but until you are totally invested in, when you know everything, when you know halacha perfectly, you are not beholden to society to dictate your actions. You can follow the Shulchan Aruch. We substitute society for the Shulchan Aruch out of ignorance. We allow people to tell us what to do because we don't know any better. If we know more than all of them, then we don't need to conform to them because we have something greater to conform to. We don't have to conform to the whims of society because we can conform directly to the ratzon of the Ribono Shel Olam. We can conform directly to Hashem. And the same, of course, is true, that simple application in the world of knowledge, in the impetus that it should give us to learn more and better all of the time. But it's even more simply true in Avodas Hashem.
If I know that the world doesn't like what I'm doing, but what I am doing is bringing nachas to the borei olam, I can do it with confidence, I can do it with pride, and I can do it with simcha. It's true, little old ladies. You may not like it, but that doesn't bother me because you're not my audience. Because I am speaking to and appealing to and trying to bring nachas to the borei olam. And if I have confidence that I'm doing that, if there is a wedding going on, if I'm dancing there, and there's a chasen and kala and a marriage between my limited self and the infinite God to whom I pray and to whom I dream about having any sort of semblance of dveikus with, then I can do anything and I can do it with pride. There is much effort that goes into building and accomplishing and achieving, like I said, even a shemetz of what Rav Rosenzweig described, the Yom Shekulo LaHashem. But make no mistake, that is what we're doing. And perhaps, again, I'm not explaining now, you need Rabbi Charlock for that, I'm not explaining now the chasima of Yom Kippur. But maybe Yom HaDin, we should just add a little yud. Maybe Yom HaDin for us, for me, should become Yom HaDayan. It's not the only day in which we are judged. It is the day in which we embrace HaKadosh Baruch Hu as being a judge in the first place. Because we have many judges. We are all familiar with the fact that we are being judged all the time. How we look and the complexion of our face, the clothing that we wear and our skills on the court. Later on it gets substituted for how well we read, how quick we learn, how sharp we are in shiur. We're always playing to a crowd. How often is our dayan the borei olam? How often do we say the judge that we care about, the person to whom will render a verdict? It doesn't make a difference when, and it doesn't even make a difference what. That's a different idea, a deeper idea for a different time. But it makes no difference when, and it makes no difference what. What is significant today, as I go through Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros, as we are Mamlech HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what is significant today is not the what he will judge or when he will judge. It is simply that he is the judge. That in my life, I establish and acknowledge that the audience to which I am appealing is the borei olam. If I can accomplish on Rosh Hashanah as the Yom HaDin, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is my dayan, and ultimately my soul dayan, that's the only judgment that matters to me, then I can accomplish anything, then I can be assured of everything that it means, to be judged by the Ribono Shel Olam, to acknowledge his judgment and his role in my life, is a greater gift than any positive verdict I can hope for. Even as I alluded to a minute ago, it's not really for now, but even a negative verdict, when it's tachas hashkachas habore, when it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I acknowledge as my dayan, that's the greatest gift anybody could hope for. So we should continue to invest in our own space program. We should continue to appreciate and enjoy the smorgasbord of opportunities in Ruchnius and Gashmius that have been laid out before us in our generation like never before. But we should know at all times that all of the fuel and all of the energy being dedicated to getting there, the there is to the center of the universe, the there is to the Ribono Shel Olam and the borei olam. And we should know that all of the celebration and all of the party, all of that, eat and drink and enjoy, because the whole world is hilula dami, the whole world is a wedding. The whole world is geared towards this celebration and union and this marriage of man and God together, something hopefully over these days of Yom Noram we'll be zocha to together. Have a ksiva ksima tova. Enjoying?
Huh?
Are you enjoying? Is he enjoying?
Great. How's Yoni?
He's happy?
Yoni seems very happy.
Great. It's great that he's there.
We spent Shabbos together. He was very happy about it.
Good. Very, very good. I know he had some concerns in the beginning. What's going on? Sure, I was so excited to see you last week. Good. Things going well here?
Sure.
Great to see you.
I was going to ask you all about Yoni.
I'm sorry, we're so late. Part of the problem was that I realized it was because of the Yudas Bar Mitzvah and we have a wedding in America. It's going to be like forever now.
Welcome back.
Okay, good. I know at the beginning he had some concerns, you know, about the way he was coming in with some of the other guys. But he looks like he's doing good. He's rushing. Pretty good. It's great to see you.
I'm going to have those two.
Yeah.
I'm going to need two more packs.
Yeah.
I need a break.
There's only one team that's going to hold you, right?
In fact,
need a break. No, shot.
Stop recording.
Sure.